This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and I've got a question for you. Are you a Stoic? That ancient Roman philosophy, Stoicism, is built on virtue, reason, and self-control, and it's been gaining popularity in a world that just seems to get crazier and crazier. My guest today is a self-declared Stoic. He's Robert Rosenkrantz, the author of The Stoic Capitalist, Advice for the Exceptionally Ambitious. This book takes a deep dive into how Stoic principles can lead to personal, financial, and social success. It charts his path from a small, cramped family apartment in post-war New York City to becoming a billionaire dealmaker and founder of Open to Debate, a nonprofit that hosts nationally broadcast debates about the toughest issues of the day. Through a mix of memoir and philosophy from the likes of Seneca and Marcus Aurelius, The Stoic Capitalist illustrates the power of rational thinking and purposeful action in all parts of life. We talk about Rosenkrantz's political journey from a New Frontier liberal to more of a libertarian-leaning Reagan Republican to a philanthropist deeply committed to promoting intense but civil debate. We also talk about how the innovation that undergirds capitalism displaces people, not just economically, but culturally, and how to make it easier for people to adapt to the creative destruction that's necessary for improvement in living standards. This interview was recorded live at an event in New York City. Go to reason.com/events to get information about our future events. Here is The Reason Interview with Robert Rosenkrantz. Let's start with the kind of obvious question. Why this book at this time?
Well, I like to think that this book is both timeless and timely. The timeless part of it is that these are ideas that are 2,300 years old. Born Stoic philosophy, born in Athens, really developed in Rome as an influential philosophical body of thought that influenced Marcus Aurelius. That was my introduction to it. And the ideas, I think, are valid to this day and offer people a road to a better and happier life. The Stoic.
Can you summarize quickly, what are the basic principles of Stoicism?
The basic principles of Stoicism, I would say, is privileging rationality as our highest human attribute, and asking that we use reason to regulate emotion, and particularly the emotions of anger and fear, which can be the most destructive. Stoic philosophy also takes into account the idea of time as our most limited resource, and asks us to use our time very consciously. It takes into account the idea of impermanence, of embracing change, expecting change. It includes the idea of doing less, actually, for peace of mind, do less, but do it with greater concentration. Focus on those things that are truly important. And finally, it really emphasizes acting for the benefit of society. And those are some of the very basic ideas. And it's a book, in a sense, of applied philosophy. These are ideas that I was almost a natural-born Stoic. And I was able to use these ideas to cope with some very difficult situations as a child, to achieve a substantial measure of success as an adult. And so I wanted to share some of those ideas, and that's why I wrote the book. But I do think it's also timely in the sense that it celebrates values that are somewhat under threat right now. Values like the Enlightenment values, the values of self-reliance, an appreciation for the genius of the U.S. Constitution, the idea that America offers equality of opportunity, and that's the critical thing, not equality of outcomes, for example.
Do you think those threats, are they coming primarily from the left or the right, or you know, what are the threats that come from the left to challenge that, and what are the ones that are coming from the right that might challenge that understanding of the American, I don't even want to say the American founding, the American experiment?
Well, I think from the left maybe is coming the idea that, and this is a longstanding philosophical question of whether justice involves the outcome or involves the process. And the left has always sort of felt like distributive justice and the way in which the goods made in society are distributed is a kind of a central issue, whereas I think the right would more look at it from the standpoint of, is the process by which people achieved whatever it is fair? If it involved coercion, if it involves force, if it involved fraud, of course that's something that would be deplored, but if it's free exchange between free people, that's a fine process, and whatever the results are would be
do fine. You worry, I mean, you know, coming out of the Biden years, let's say, as much as we, you know, we America now, we want to forget a lot, right? Yeah. You know, we want to forget COVID. I think we want to forget Biden. We might want to forget Trump as well, for if we can. But in the Biden years, there was an emphasis on equity, you know, the idea that what mattered was equality of outcome. And we can understand why that's problematic. You were just talking about, you know, if people are free to make trades and to, you know, enter into, you know, arrangements with people, that's good. Right now we have a Republican president, a conservative Republican president, who's saying, no, you can't do that. Like, well, how do you feel about Donald Trump these days?
Well, I first of all, I don't think I would regard him as a conservative in any real sense. And I think there are a lot of challenges to the values that I would think would be central to the, at least my sense of conservative values, included free trade. It included a strong role for America abroad. It included deregulation. It included a relatively limited government. I mean, those all seemed like bedrock ideas, and particularly a kind of belief that America was a force for good in the world and should be an active and leading member of a global community. And those ideas are no longer very much present in the Republican Party. So,
and not even, I mean, it's a big thing to say we can hold aside in military intervention, but I mean, it seems like even in terms of trade, even in terms of kind of cultural exchange, the Trump faction seems to be pulling away from that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've sort of lost the political constituency in this country for economic dynamism, and we've lost the political constituency that really has confidence in America as a global force for good.
One of the most interesting aspects of the book, I think, are the, you know, you talk about business adventures, and those are fascinating. You talk about the Stoics. You talk about how Stoicism and cognitive behavioral therapy kind of intermesh with one another pretty well. And that's not trying to say we don't have emotions, but it's recognizing them, understanding them, and regulating them in a powerful way. But you start out talking about your childhood, and feeling unsafe and insecure, and that's kind of where you start from. Can you describe a little bit, what year were you born again?
1942.
Okay, 1942, and you grew up in the...
I grew up on the west side of Manhattan at a time, we'll think of it more like West Side Story than today's gentrified West Side.
Certainly, yeah.
It's a pretty tough neighborhood.
And you talk, well, the West Side, it's always hilarious when you read about, you know, what are we going to do with the West Side? Well into stories like that in the 70s and even the 80s. And it's like, what? How could the West Side be anything other than what it is today? That's part of the power of your book. Talk about why you felt fear and insecurity.
Well, I think, I'll talk about it. Well, let me say this. The we lived on a ground floor apartment. It was tiny. Didn't have a real kitchen, just a little hole-in-the-wall kitchenette. My parents slept in a pull-out couch in the living room. I slept in the bedroom. And my mother was a clerk in a drugstore. My father was unemployed when I was about 7 years old, which is the first time a kid really sees his parents in relation to the larger world. And they were worried about the electricity being cut off, or the phone being cut off, or the butcher bill getting paid. And they shared their anxiety, it was on full display with great emotional intensity for me as a child. And there's a Stoic phrase that Marcus Aurelius uses, the obstacle is the way. And that's, I think, a critical phrase, because for me, the obstacle of insecurity, that financial insecurity, gave me, for me, the way was self-reliance. I knew that I couldn't rely on my parents, and therefore I would have to figure out for myself how the world worked, and I would have to take full responsibility for myself. And I had to do that at a really early age. So the obstacle became the way in that in that respect.
You also you're Jewish, but were you bar mitzvahed? You were not.
No, my parents were kind of more like atheists. I mean, they identified as Jewish, but I had no Jewish upbringing. But
and then, I mean, you talk in the book. It's interesting that you knew there was anti-Semitism in the world, and that you were a big reader as a kid. And, you know, there were two basic ways for Jews to kind of navigate a society in which they're outsiders, which they always were, because at this point, you know, the state of Israel hadn't even been created. And you could either become very Jewish, and be away from the regular society, majority society, or you could assimilate. Could you talk a little bit about how you navigated that choice and how that plays into Stoicism?
Well, there's a chapter in the book which is called You Face Prejudice, So What? And my sort of sense of the world then was that there was a lot of social anti-Semitism. I mean, it was extraordinary by today's standards. Most law firms didn't hire Jews. Most investment banking firms didn't. Most large industrial companies didn't. Many, many New York co-ops, most clubs. I mean, it was blatant and extreme by today's standards. And I just felt like, well, that's the way the world works. But I had looked at, because I didn't have role models at home, or really in my school that I could look up to, I became a voracious reader of biographies. So again, the obstacle is you don't have role models. The way is you read biographies to figure out. And a number of the biographies I read were about Jews who had succeeded in the world, but they had succeeded largely by assimilating. Mm-hmm. And that seemed like the right approach, or at least the approach that I chose, in part because I had no positive things from the religion. I had no, I'd never went to a temple or synagogue with my parents, never had a bar mitzvah. So I had nothing from being Jewish other than being discriminated against. Yeah. And it just seemed like this was part of the society. There's a Stoic principle that some things are up to us, some things are not. Epictetus says that. And to spend a lot of time and emotional energy on things that are not up to you is just fruitless. So you simply adapt to the world as you find it. And the way that I wanted to adapt was sort of, again, a biographical role model with the Rothschilds,
right,
who had assimilated at the very highest levels of society. And that seemed like a pretty nice model.
Yeah, and you mentioned it in passing that your parents were proud of Marx, Freud, and Einstein as Jews. But like, other than that, you know, it doesn't mean you're going to become Jewish, right? The Rothschilds were a role model. You also found Joseph Kennedy Sr. a role model. Can you explain what was the appeal of Joe Kennedy to you?
Well, Joe Kennedy faced more or less the same kind of discrimination as a Irish kid at Harvard as I faced as a Jewish kid at Yale. Mm-hmm. And so I identified with that aspect of his life. I also found his style of capitalism kind of interesting. I mean, I had read biographies of people like Carnegie and Rockefeller, who built the giant American smokestack industries. But Joe Kennedy was more like a surfer. He'd ride a wave of the stock market or banking or the movie industry. And I kind of like that aspect of his life. I like the fact that he included public service. He was an ambassador. He was the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. I liked his dynastic impulse. And I knew that he was kind of anti-Semitic. I knew he had some serious flaws. But I was willing to learn from sinners as well as from saints.
Yeah. Do you, Marcus Aurelius, certainly Seneca, another famous Stoic, has maybe not a lot to answer for, but they lived morally ambiguous lives, right? So how does one learn from like a Joe Kennedy without either becoming like him and becoming kind of morally nihilistic or refusing to take examples from where you find them?
Well, I think, again, one of the key values that has really worked for me and that I think is a kind of a timeless value is the value of critical thinking. Mm-hmm. As I think you mentioned, my mother was a Marxist. She talked at home about, a lot about Marxist ideology. Saying things like, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. I was 10 years old and I thought, well, I'm getting good grades. Should I be giving some of my grade points to kids who are lazy and stupid? I mean, what sense does that make? And then needs, I mean, what does that mean? And who decides what you need? I mean, the whole thing seemed crazy to me. But it's sort of, again, the obstacle is bad ideas. The way is critical thinking. Mm-hmm. And, reading widely is great, but reading with a critical mind about what you're reading is really the important thing.
You mentioned you in the book there's a political journey, and you talk about how JFK, particularly as president, electrified you. I think you used that term. And you also worked with John Lindsay. And, some of you may remember a year or so ago, I interviewed the author of a new biography of Milton Friedman. And Friedman's, one of his great shame was helping to work out withholding tax as a technical problem during World War II. And he always was mad about that. You helped John Lindsay, as mayor of New York, come up with the way of applying an income tax to New York City. So
yes, that is the most shameful chapter of my career. I was the draftsman of the New York City income tax code.
So, that hurts. But what was it about people like Kennedy and Lindsay that really captured your imagination?
Well, I think, again, looking at these biographies to try to figure out, I read biographies voraciously as a child and as a young adult, looking at them as sort of how to do it manuals in life. Not only how to achieve success, what was this person doing at 16, at 22? What did he do after he became powerful and recognized? And what did he do about his family? What did he do about public service? What did he do about philanthropy? So I had the idea that public service was part of the well-lived life, that the Stoic idea of working for the benefit of society was indeed part of a well-lived life. And Kennedy certainly created this sort of idea that public service was a very noble pursuit. Mm-hmm. Yale was fully, I went to Yale as an undergraduate. I was actually the youngest kid in my class there, but it was part of the culture that successful people would spend part of their time in public service and bounce back and forth between private and public roles. And Kennedy was electrifying in that sense.
Yeah. With somebody like Lindsay, your political story is you start out as a kind of new frontier Democrat. You talk about kind of moving to a kind of Reagan Republicanism, and now you're in someplace else maybe. But what was it like to see the kind of Lindsay vision of a large welfare state, of a government that wanted to do good for lots of people? Do you agree that that failed on some level? And if so, you know, what are the lessons that we learned from that?
Well, I think it's a very complicated question. I mean, I think in the early days of my sort of adulthood, and the political parties were very different than they are mm-hmm. today. The Republican Party included real free-spending liberals like Nelson Rockefeller and John Lindsay. Democratic Party included real national security hawks like Henry Jackson. And there was a saying in those days, politics stops at the water's edge, mm-hmm. which meant that national security issues and foreign policy issues were sort of off limits mm-hmm. for partisan squabbling. And so we didn't really come at these questions from a kind of partisan mm-hmm. perspective. I really became a conservative, I would say, through lived experience. I mean, I was a tax lawyer, and I just saw the way that, for myself, the way the tax code would distort economic mm-hmm. behavior, would get people to behave in ways that were not really socially very productive or not very efficient uses of capital. As a banker, early on in my career, I could see badly crafted government regulations gumming up the works.
What's an example of that?
Oh, we had an early situation I had was I was trying to put together a deal that involved real estate, and one of the early ideas about public ownership of real estate. The New York State required you to project the earnings from a portfolio of real estate. The SEC forbade you to project the earnings. How do you get a deal done when you have two imperatives both going in the opposite direction? I mean, it's just frustrating.
As you became, you call it conservative, you know, what was the role of somebody like Reagan? You know, what was the role of optimism in, you know, a successful political program, and especially in relation to Stoicism? Because Stoicism, you're supposed to be realistic, but you are supposed to be moving forward, right? So how does that work?
Well, I would say, I think optimism is really important, because what you're trying to do, I mean, the Stoic idea, or one of them, is some things are up to you, some things are not. If you don't have the power to change it, don't spend a lot of time and energy. Mm-hmm. But if you can change it and it's important to you, try. And it helps to be optimistic in that thing, to make, you know, nothing in this world was ever achieved by somebody who thought it was impossible. So if you think you can do something, go for it. And if you fail, at least you're going to learn something from your failure. So I'm sort of a natural optimist, I'd mm-hmm. say. And I think for most of my adult life, America expressed a certain optimism. There was a, you know, the idea of economic dynamism, the idea of technological advances, the idea of reward, wealth creation, all of that was basically supported by our political system. And that's a pretty optimistic view. And look, change produces winners and losers, and I think we've lost that optimism, and we've lost that embrace of dynamism. But it did embody a kind of an optimistic view of what a free what America could do, and that was not a partisan feeling. That was Democrats and Republicans.
Can you point on a calendar and say this is when American optimism died, or what went into? We do seem to be in a kind of funk
and have been for a while. Like, people are fearful of the future. They're fearful of change. When did that start becoming, you know, a serious problem in American discourse, do you think?
Well, I think I write in the book a bit about, because as an impresario of debate, I've been kind of a student of the public sphere, and I think a lot of things have kind of gone structurally wrong that might have been well-intentioned. So if you'll indulge me, I'll do a little bit of political analysis here. When I was a kid, political parties chose their candidates in smoke-filled rooms. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was political professionals would pick people that they knew personally to run for office, and they were generally reasonably qualified for the offices they were running for. But that process was seen as undemocratic and untransparent. So direct primaries came in, and the candidates were going to be chosen by the members of the party. Then if you take that and interpose it over a system where 90% of all congressional seats are safe for one party or the other, the only election that counts is the primary. Well, who shows up for primaries? It's the most liberal Democrats, it's the most conservative Republicans. So the parties were pulled far away from the center. Center becomes almost political homelessness. Again, when I was a kid, there were three networks. So if you owned one of those networks, what was your strategy? Broad tent, alienate as few people as possible, bring in as many viewers as you can. Multiplicity of, then you have cable TV, 40 different news channels. What's your right strategy as an owner? Mm. Create a really tight emotional bond with a small group of people, but they're so tied to you that you can't run a cable company without including your network. So right. That's the secret of Fox News. That's why it's the most profitable network by far. But again, that produces polarization. Mm-hmm. You then have campaign finance reform. Again, well-intentioned. But if you're going to spend $100 million running for Senate, and you need to raise that in $2,900 maximum pops, how do you get people to reach for their checkbook? Mm. You get them angry, or you get them fearful. You say, you're going to lose your gun rights, or you're going to lose your abortion rights. And I believe in sensible compromise as a way to rational governance. People don't write checks for that.
Is there a way? I mean, I think everybody would agree that, you know, politics is bizarre right now, but and maybe some kind of centrism, not moderate, but centrism would be good. But then in the cultural arena, like, it is so much, television is so much better now, right? Because we have an infinite number of channels to choose from. Art is so much more interesting. Is there a way to detach politics from, you know, culture in that sense?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, one of my favorite books that I talk about a little bit is Steven Pinker's Enlightenment Now. And he makes the point that in so many fields of human endeavor, things have gotten a hell of a lot better.
Right.
And I've seen it in my lifetime. Across medical care, it's better. Treatment of blacks, gays, women, much is better. I've seen a billion people move out of abject poverty in China and hundreds of millions in Central Europe. I mean, so much stuff has improved. But the conspicuous exception is politics. It's gotten a lot worse. And Pinker calls it an irrationality magnet.
Right.
So the Stoic approach is to accept change, expect change, be grateful for the period where politics was working out. And I mean, frankly, I've turned my attention elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, Marcus Aurelius was an emperor, so he could afford not to care about politics, right?
And he couldn't quite.
Yeah. And Seneca, of course, committed suicide because Nero, his former student, basically told him to. So I'm not sure the Stoics and politics match up too well, right? Could you talk about how you made your fortune? The book, the subtitle is, it's advice for the exceptionally ambitious. And you've talked about how, being able to regulate fear fear and anger are important things. The book is filled with moments where you decide to take a leap from a very comfortable position to something where it's unknown. What's the best instance of that in your life? And what drove you to do that?
Well, probably the best instance was I was 35 years old and I was, an investor asked me to leave what was quite a lucrative partnership at a firm called Oppenheimer & Company to start a business doing private equity or leveraged buyouts, it was called in that day, in those days. And I volunteered to risk 100% of my liquid net worth in that firm. And I did it on terms where if the firm lost 20% of its capital, I would be wiped out. And for those of you who know this sort of standard idea in buyout business, the manager typically gets 20% off the top of the profits. I said, and my investor was pushing back against that. And I said, okay, I'll put 100%. And he was pushing back against it for feeling that it was asymmetrical. It was sort of heads he loses, tails I win. And I said, okay, we'll make it symmetrical. I want 50% of the profits. I'll absorb 50% of the losses. And to make that decision, actually to agree to such a thing or propose it, you really have to overcome an incredible amount of fear. And that is, again, a Stoic idea of rationality prevailing over emotion. It seemed very courageous, but a calculation of risk and reward would tell you that I was making a bet that was hugely in my favor, even though I was assuming risks that I could have avoided. Yeah.
I think this book is, and I don't think this is the primary function of it, but it's one of the best arguments for kind of capitalism with a human face, to coin a phrase. Your deal-making idea is that the deals that work are ones where everybody involved is better off. Can you kind of explain that and talk about that in context of, the way that LBOs, leverage buyouts, and, I'm 61, so I started paying attention to this stuff in the 80s, and you would hear about private equity, and you would hear about corporate raiders, and you would hear about leverage buyouts where, outside investors would take over a company and strip it for assets, and then they would get rich, but everybody else would be left worse off. Is that a fundamental misunderstanding? It certainly is of your philosophy, but of LBOs in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a caricature. I don't think that's the essential part of the business. I do think things have shifted a lot. I mean, my biggest satisfaction was really building companies, and so it wasn't just going and sort of firing people and operating a little more efficiently and profiting that way. It was more seeing the strategic value in something and then exploiting it. My first serious money on my own was made in a lawn and garden products company where I saw that there was a social trend toward organic gardening materials. It was a product that you couldn't ship very far. So we bought what was the largest company in the industry, but it only served the Midwest market. We used that to do a consolidation nationally and built what became the only national supplier that a Kmart or the big garden chains could work with.
So you literally made money from selling, if not manure, compost.
Yeah.
Right? but that's what people wanted, right?
Putting dirt in bags or the son of the founder of the thing, who was kind of a womanizer and a heavy drinker and actually happened to be a very good businessman, but completely at odds with his dad. He would refer to the business as number one and the number two business.
Yeah. So, you know, billionaires in general, capitalism in general, are kind of in a bad odor right now. And I think, you know, it was less than a decade ago that one of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief advisors said that every billionaire is a policy failure. We still hear echoes of that. What is, you know, what is the best way to sell capitalism as a system that is, you know, a positive good?
Well, I think economic dynamism is a positive good. Technological advance is a positive good. But those things are disruptive. They create billionaires, but they also create discomfort and for a lot of people. And, you know, the Stoic idea of adapting to change and expecting change is a lot easier for cognitive elites. It's a lot easier for people with money and good educations than it is for, you know, people who are bending metal for a living.
Right.
In a factory, at a labor union wage, who are now having to compete with people across the globe making a fifth of what they are, or maybe less. So,
but we can't stop that dynamism, right? If we say we have to protect those jobs, then we get locked into a system that becomes less and less productive.
Well, I think we are sort of moving in that direction. As a society, I mean, we're moving from a society that emphasized wealth creation to one that maybe is emphasizing wealth redistribution. But the justification for billionaires is that they make their money by creating value for society. And if you build a successful business, you're not taking anything away. You're building it successful because you're creating a product that people want and need, or it's successful because you're creating an environment where your employees can be more creative or productive, right, or you're making efficient use of a scarce resource.
Wait, so you're going to
doing something right?
You're defending Taylor Swift, who recently became a billionaire, that she is not making the world worse by selling lots of music.
Well, it's interesting. We did an open to debate. Topic that I really liked, which was Taylor Swift deserves her billions.
Yeah.
Because I could never get an actual billionaire to defend himself in debate, but I thought Taylor Swift would be a great example. That's a good point, because people can understand how Taylor Swift made her money and nobody could really object to it.
Right.
People don't understand how Wall Streeters make their money. They don't understand how hedge fund guys make their money. They don't understand what Goldman Sachs contributes to the world. They may understand like Silicon Valley capitalism. They can understand that Google makes it easier for them to get the world's knowledge, or ChatGPT. They can understand that Apple is a cool, sleek device. They can understand that Amazon helps them buy anything under the sun very efficiently, right, with a few strokes of the keyboard. So people can understand what Silicon Valley has brought to their lives that's positive, whereas I think very few people can really understand what finance capitalism brings that's positive. And I think that's part of why billionaires have gotten a bad rap.
Yeah.
The culture, I mean, I sometimes ask, I said there's one Hollywood film that sort of glorifies a billionaire, and can anybody name what it is? And I usually get blank stares.
Is it Other People's Money?
No, it's Batman.
Oh, okay. Can you explain? How does Batman valorize billionaires?
He's a billionaire.
Okay, that's good. And he's the thin line between chaos and chaos and anarchy, or chaos and positive living. Talk about open to debate. This, you know, it fits in with the Stoic philosophy. You are trying to stage debates about things that matter in ways that actual information gets discussed. Why did you start doing that? I know it had started as Intelligence Squared US. You leased the name or licensed the name from a British group, rapidly became bigger than that. How do you measure success for something like Open to Debate?
Well, I think for me, the impulse, again, it goes back almost to these childhood reading of biographies. I felt that philanthropy was a part of a well-lived life. And I never believed in this idea of, quote, giving back, because I didn't think you got the means to be philanthropic by hollowing out or taking anything. So you didn't owe anything to anybody. But I like the fact that people like Carnegie and Rockefeller established what I thought was a great American tradition of private philanthropy. But it was not just writing checks. It was creating the institutions that they felt the society.
But you're saying the University of Chicago is worth a damn?
University of Chicago, Rockefeller yeah. Institute, Carnegie Mellon,
right.
Carnegie Hall, the libraries. Yeah. I mean, these people were using their talents and abilities to bring into being things that they felt would meet social needs. Now, my means are tiny fraction of what theirs were, but I still had that as an ideal of what can I create philanthropically that might move the needle in the right direction. And I was sort of feeling like the state of public discourse in America was pretty sorry. People couldn't have civil discussion about policy issues or political issues. And my wife actually gave me a wonderful gift. She hired a scholar to survey the state of the world on public discourse. And the program that really most captured my imagination was this Intelligence Squared, which was Oxford Union debates in London. And I thought, okay, this is a nice model. I can bring this to the United States as a philanthropy. It's within my means to do it. National Public Radio picked it up very, very quickly. And I saw debate as a way of privileging reason over emotion, of privileging facts over ideology, of creating a kind of contempt-free zone in which people would listen respectfully to the other side of contentious issues. And that seemed to be a real value that was almost 20 years ago we started it, and I think I can't say that the state of public discourse is better.
I guess
I could say what we do is needed more than ever.
If correlation is causation, this might be worse than the New York City income tax, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But
we did do three debates today, and we did them at the Council on Foreign Relations. That's why I was wearing a suit, actually. And they were all three about Trump's foreign policy. One was, is the Russia-Ukraine policy a reset or a defeat for America? Is Trump's America a reliable ally? And the third one was, is Trump good for Israel?
Well, we can look for those on Open to Debate. What was the best Open to Debate that you've done or event that you've done, would you say, and why?
Well, we've done about 350 or 400 debates, so I can't say which is the favorite one. But I will I'll cite one that I think would be particularly resonant for a Reason audience, and that was the debate on legalize the market in human organs.
How could that even be up for debate?
Oh, I mean, the yuck factor in that was just overwhelming. But we had four panelists, two of whom were organ donors, two of whom were organ recipients. And they framed it as, look, if somebody in the Philippines can sell a kidney and get the money to get an education or start a business or care for aging parents, and somebody in the United States can get off a dialysis machine and live a normal life, and that transaction is made by these two people, well-informed, understanding what they're doing, who are you to impose your moral sentiments on that? And once it was framed that way, the audience opinion changed enormously. Yeah. That debate also led to a book by a New Yorker writer who happened to be in the audience, who was so struck by the extreme altruism that it took to, let's say, donate a kidney in the absence of a market.
Yeah.
So that was, I'd say, an incredibly powerful debate along the lines of defending markets as almost life and death matters right. against what would be an emotional reaction that most people would have.
Yeah, the repugnance, the wisdom of repugnance, as former Bush bioethics czar Leon Cass once talked about this type of thing. You are interested in longevity as well, even though the Stoics say the one thing that you can't get more of is time. You're putting money as well as your own body on the line for longevity treatments. Can you talk about what are the things that are most exciting about that, and why is that a good use of your time and resources?
Well, in a way, it was part of my pivot away from politics. I was, very involved with center-right think tanks. I was involved as a political donor, and I really felt like this was not going in the right direction. And I kind of, we had done a debate back in 2016 on the proposition lifespans are long enough. And I might have thought they were, because extensions of lifespan seem to be associated with just people lingering on longer in frail conditions or cognitive decline in nursing homes, and that didn't seem very interesting. But somebody made a distinction that I really resonated with me between health span and lifespan. And then when I started getting into it, I realized that there was a very fundamental and very exciting question, which is, why do we age in the first instance? What is going on a molecular level with our cells that make them less fit for purpose and more vulnerable to disease as time goes by? And there was practically no money and no research working on this very basic thing, even though it was pretty obvious that most diseases, the biggest risk factor is age. Mm-hmm. So I got kind of excited about that. I met a lot of the key scientists, and I realized that there was a number of avenues that seemed very promising, very much underfunded. And I started doing that kind of myself, because I thought I could make a difference with my own philanthropy. It turned out that I was more of a thought leader than a money leader, because in the four or five intervening years, it had been literally billions of dollars of private capital and private philanthropy that have come into this.
You would think also whatever pharmaceutical company cures death, they'll probably be able to charge a lot of money for that.
You're right. And that's part of the problem in a way. I view if science can give us 10 years or 15 years of longer health span,
right.
That strikes me as almost the greatest gift to human flourishing that science can possibly do. And I think there are a lot of very promising approaches. Some of them involve genetic reprogramming. Some of them involve stem cells. Some of them involve senescent cells. But even the most sort of helpful thing for most people would simply be diet and exercise.
Right.
And I think Stoicism actually helps in that regard, because if you're emotionally stressed out all the time, if you're sort of have angry emotions, you're jealous, you're fearful, you're pissed off, it's very hard to muster the discipline that it might take for diet, for exercise, for doing the things that would lead to longer health span. Mm-hmm. So I think kind of mental equanimity is actually very helpful in making the small sacrifices that ultimately will buy you more time, which by quality time, it's the time when you're healthy, obviously. Yeah.
I guess as a final question before we go to audience Q&A, and we're going to have a microphone brought over here and people can line up for that. What is the Stoic capitalist approach to death? Because death is inevitable, but you kind of want to keep it as far in the future as possible. Can you reflect a little bit on, you know, how should we think about death in order to have a more productive life?
Well, I mean, you're not going to be there to experience it, so you shouldn't spend a lot of time worrying about it. It really is saying what's up to us and what's not. And extending our health spans is up to us, and we can actively do things about that, but, you know, nobody's going to live forever. And Marcus Aurelius says, it's crazy to wish for what's impossible. So there
and
you go.
And also not to think too much about tomorrow, right? Because then you don't do anything today.
Well, you certainly don't want to live in the future to the point of... I mean, I think the Stoic idea would really be that the fear of an undesired outcome is usually worse than the outcome itself. And a lot of people get paralyzed by fear. A lot of people devote a huge amount of emotional energy to being afraid of something they have no control over. And the Stoics would say that that's kind of a waste of time. Spend your time and energy on what you do have control over. And in the health arena, you have control over your diet. You have control over exercise. You have control over getting first-class medical attention. Do those things.
All right, we're going to stop the interview portion right now. The book is The Stoic Capitalist, Advice for the Exceptionally Ambitious. Robert Rosenkranz, thanks for talking to Reason.